Well, I'm Peter Dunn, and today I'm with Professor Martin Parker, who's a professor in Warwick Business School, to talk to him about his new book, Alternative Business, Outlaws, Crime and Culture, which has just been published by Routledge. And your book begins, Martin, with another Martin Parker, where you talk about another Martin Parker from the 17th century, 1632, who enters his tale of Robin Hood into the register of tales of the day, or the copyright library of its day. And you say that's the first minute when outlaws, or popular outlaws, are commodified or turned into a commodity themselves. Is that what you were saying there? Is that something you intended to say about?
That's right, Peter. And I suppose the book starts with that little conceit because of the delicious coincidence, really, that this other Martin Parker writes this prose poem called A True Tale of Robin Hood. And effectively what that Martin Parker, the other one, is doing is bringing together a whole series of legends and myths and some poetry too, some ballad poetry. And it provides us with one of the kind of first modern representations of what Robin was like, which brings together a whole bunch of stuff, really, in terms of the idea of redistribution, the notion that Robin was a noble, that he had a noble background and so on, and also that he was, in a sense, an outlaw, but someone who was a kind of, I describe in the book, as a sort of sparkling-eyed villain, someone who's very hard not to like, even though they might have been doing slightly disreputable things. But of course all of this this description of the outlaw is then brought together in the kind of the modern myth that we have now, the idea of the outlaw as someone who is challenging illegitimate power. So in a sense the kind of the hinge of the book is to look at the ways in which a whole variety of different outlaws contest the supposedly legitimate authorities of the time.
And you cover a number of areas. You cover noble outlaws like Robin Hood, and we'll go on to talk about pirates. I mean, we'll go on to talk about the mafia. And the book seemed to be a sort of divide into looking at these groups as a business concept in one way, and in another way looking at them in an almost a sociological way as well, and it tended to be a blend of the two. So we had this, you started with Robin Hood being turned into a commodity, into something that this Martin Parker entered the stationer's register. And then you move on to entirely the opposite side of the fence, with Hobsbawm turning Robin Hood into a Marxist social bandit and fighter for freedom. How did
that
work?
Right. Yeah, that's. I mean, it's that kind of tension, in a sense, that preoccupies me for much of the book, I guess. So you have that, the idea that the outlaw is continually commodified, they're continually sold. One of the kind of starting points for my research on this book was watching the first Pirates of the Caribbean film. You know, fantastic, swaggering portrayal of this delightful pirate who's continually evading authority. But at the same time as it's presenting, this film is presenting someone who is challenging legitimate authority. The film was made by the Disney company, and I think I'm right in saying that the three films, I'm not sure about the fourth, but the three films managed to get about $2 billion at the box office. So clearly these are both portrayals of some kind of romantic individualism, but also commercial products which are continually being sold. So you mention Eric Hobsbawm, who's a very influential Marxist historian. Hobsbawm writes this book, well, there's actually three incarnations of it, but the first version of it in the 1950s, where he is essentially re-describing the bandit as a kind of Che Guevara-type figure, one embedded in our history, but one that kind of represents popular dissent in all sorts of ways. So early versions of Robin, very often, for example, extremely hostile to the Catholic Church. Robin is brutal to clerics that he meets in the forest. He stabs one so hard that the knife gets stuck in the tree, and he's continually castrating them. Not a nice man. Mm-hmm. But you get this kind of theme running through all of the subsequent bandits. Hobsbawm writes about some of them, but I've kind of added some to the list. So we get this sort of idea of a set of people who are living by another law, a set of people who are somehow outside society, but in a sense are still heroic, are still figures of admiration for us in various ways.
Hobsbawm himself bizarrely tries to claim Robin Hood in this way, but yet sort of has to admit in the end, you say, that the social bandit can never win, or can never win in a way that Hobsbawm wants him to overflow the state or whatever. Is that a fair analysis?
In Hobsbawm's case, it is, yes. I mean, Hobsbawm is a good party man, so he would assume that the only ways in which you can get actual enduring political change is through some kind of party politics, an organised, institutionalised form of politics. For Hobsbawm, of course, that's politics of the left in various different ways. I guess my interest isn't necessarily in the idea that the outlaw can't achieve something, but more in the notion that the outlaw symbolises something, symbolises a particular kind of longing, a possibility, the idea that the world could somehow be different. And that seems to be particularly relevant in a culture which is increasingly dominated by large business organisations, and the idea of the individual having a career which is essentially circumscribed by a variety of institutional constraints. So kind of working for the man in that rather 1960s way then becomes almost the limit of our ambitions. But yet we still have this fascination with bandits, outlaws, robbers and so on. So when I was trying to do some work on 20th century film, one of the extraordinary things that you see is just how popular and powerful images of the bandit have been. And indeed, some of the very first films made are films about Robin, they're about organised criminals, they're about outlaws of different kinds. And my guess is, and this is no more than a guess, that something like 25% of the output of Hollywood in the 20th century was essentially portraying bandit films, of various, you know, robbers of various different kinds.
As we're on film, and to go back to a film you mentioned earlier, which brings us into Pirates, Pirates of the Caribbean and Captain Jack, it's interesting to see that you saw Captain Jack as producing an image of pirates that we're not expecting, that were metrosexual pirates. I like the idea of Captain Jack as metrosexual. Well, he's not the only metrosexual pirate called Jack, because, of course, we have Captain Jack Harkness in Doctor Who, now, who starts off essentially as a pirate freebooter, sort of nicking spaceships or whatever. So we have two metrosexual Captain Jacks in your view. Is that the fair?
Your science fiction fascinations betray you, Peter. I think that's very true. I think there's ways in which the symbol of the outlaw embodies all sorts of slightly tricky contradictions and tensions. So around, say, the issue of sexuality, very often the outlaw is portrayed, the male outlaw is portrayed as having a particularly rapacious kind of sexuality, of being irresistible to the woman and so on. But you also get a variety of presentations of same-sex sexuality too, say, particularly with the historical figure of the pirate. There have been a number of attempts to suggest that pirates were not only much more accommodating to same-sex partnerships, but also that they were figures who were, in a sense, kind of putatively democratic in ways that were very different to the navies of the time. So the idea of the pirate ship, for example, as a highly democratic form of social organisation, one in which captains could be elected, but if they weren't doing terribly well, then they could be effectively dethroned too, and another member of the crew could be put in their stead. So you get these kind of huge paradoxes, in a way, where we have an image of kind of violence and criminality, but also associated with many of the kind of the images of democracy and individualism and tolerance, if you like, that we would regard as being quite, you know, 21st century understandings.
And indeed, on that democratic thing, you take that further in the book and you talk about pirates sharing their treasure to such an extent I felt as if the pirate ships were like a branch of John Lewis's sort of co-op or something.
Well, it's very difficult to know what the historical truth of the pirate was. So we've got lots of documentation about the golden age of piracy, for example. So it's usually sort of the end of the 17th, early 18th century and so on. And many of the names now echo down to us, and lots of films made about them in the 20th century too. The image of the pirate at the time was certainly as an emancipatory figure. Pirates were the kind of rock stars of their day. Prints of them would be stuck to people's walls, songs would be sung about them, there would be reports of them in the broadsheets of the time and so on. And I think they're very often seen to be figures who are both challenging some of the illegitimate authorities of the state, but also, remember, they're associated with smugglers too. So pirates, like smugglers, are characters who bring to ordinary people goods that would otherwise be too expensive as a result of state tax legislation. So there's both a kind of an economic rationale, but also I think a kind of cultural rationale for the elevation of the pirate at the time. Now, with regard to the sharing of the treasure and the loot and so on, the evidence for that is pretty clear. So we have pirate articles, for example, that specify quite clearly what the rights and responsibilities of individual pirates would be, even down to what time at night you're allowed to play music on deck, or what the compensations would be if you lost an arm or a leg or a finger or an eye, or, and so on. So it looks very much like a picture of a kind of fairly democratic, communal, almost a kind of cooperative form of social organisation. It's interesting to mention John Lewis in that regard, which of course does regard itself as a partnership. I think that most pirates would have articulated their relationship with their shipmates as a partnership, and contrast that with the navies of the time, which were brutal and violent and highly hierarchical places in which forms of discipline were very often arbitrary and cruel in the extreme. So the historical record suggests that many merchant seamen and navy seamen were extremely pleased when a pirate ship came on board. They would be very enthusiastic about jumping, about going pirate, going to the other side.
Yeah, I did like this portrayal of the pirates being a much better employer than the navies. And you mentioned loss of limb there, whatever, and you go on to sort of suggest that they were a wonderful equal opportunity employer. You talk about the Robert Newton portrayals of the John John Silver people losing limbs and being compensated for them. You talk about ethnic minorities being welcomed, like the idea of the Lascars, the pirate, black pirates, etc. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that piracy was actually a much better equal opportunity employer than regular navies?
Well, I think that's probably the case for many pirates. I mean, you know, most of these pirates were probably people that you and I would have crossed the street to avoid. So, you know, let's be clear about what kind of people they were too. And there's plenty of examples of brutal cruelties carried out by pirates too. But that being said, this needs to be contrasted with the forms of social organisation we see at the time, particularly in, as I suggested, the merchant and state navies, which are very often extremely brutal and dangerous. I think, if I remember the figure rightly, for your average state navy ship, whether, you know, French, Portuguese, English and so on, something like a third of the crew would die on the voyage. You know, that was just kind of expected. And of course it was unsurprising then that the practice of press ganging was reasonably common. So we think about press ganging as a reflection of the unpopularity of that form of employment. Pirates didn't need to be press ganged. They volunteered for piracy. You know, they would, again, there are kind of contemporaneous accounts of pirates coming on board ships and basically asking the crews, do any of you want to turn? You know, do you want to come with us? And, of course, most of the crew said, yeah, yes, great. It sounds much better than what we get now. And, you know, the food's going to be better, yeah. And we can get drunk whenever we want, you know.
We can play our music after a certain
hour. After a certain hour, that's right, yeah.
But a lot of what you talk about piracy, of course, is based on what's seen in, not in reality, but in the popular, in cinema, in newspapers or whatever, in books. But you also reference that modern pirates and the ancient pirates also took their cues from popular culture. You talk about Somali pirates identifying with Robin Hood.
Yeah. I think, again, running all the way through this book is that sort of oscillation between the media or popular cultural representation of the pirate, the outlaw and so on, and the actual practices themselves. And it's very clear that those practices have been shaped by presentation. So if we take again the example of the Golden Age pirate, the Golden Age pirate was one that was being represented in the mass media of their day very consistently in, as I said, songs and ballads and broadsheets and so on. Their practices were almost certainly influenced by that sort of self-understanding. Now, if we jump forward very quickly, I'm sure we're going to get to this later, but if we jump forward quickly to, say, the 20th century, there's plenty of evidence that the Mafia, for example, engaged in all sorts of very kind of self-referential practices because of the representations of Mafia organisations in films and books and cartoons and so on in the 20th century. So in that sense, it shouldn't surprise us that there's that kind of continual relationship between, if you like, the fiction and the fact, even to the extent I would argue that in most of the cases that I write about, it's actually very difficult to disentangle some kind of pure fact from some sort of pure fiction, because the two are, they're growing together in a way. Robin's an interesting place to begin because, in a way, Robin is in historical terms, an absolute mystery. Nobody knows whether this character actually existed. So Robin is kind of a fictional fact in the way that he grows. If we look at, you know, the sort of post-16th century pirates and so on, and outlaws and highwaymen and smugglers and so on, then these are all characters that were constituted by their representations in various ways. It's a problem that historians might have with this book, because in a sense I'm denying that there is a pure history that could be understood separately from the ways in which these outlaws, these characters, have been represented in the media.
Yeah, we're sort of seeking into the map. Let's start going there, in that one example of what you've just said to me would be The Sopranos out of the Mafia, where, if I remember correctly, at least one of the actors in The Sopranos was an ex-mafioso himself. And at least one, if not more, of the folk that were in The Sopranos were actually convicted for mafioso-style activities afterwards, where that's the real and the fictional really blending together.
That's right, absolutely, yes. And we see this from the earliest days of Hollywood. So, say, many of the early cowboy films, for example, involved using outlaws, Western outlaws, as characters. But in the case of The Sopranos, the TV show from the early 2000s, that entered a kind of an incredibly complex spiral, in a sense, because what you had in The Sopranos was a bunch of writers who were very aware of both mafia history and representations of the mafia, writing about incidents and characters that sometimes had happened, or had happened and had been represented in films, and then had happened again as mafiosi had watched those films themselves. And then for quite a lot of the characters, you're absolutely right, actually recruiting people who, Italian-Americans, who had been involved in mafia activity of various kinds. The actor who plays Paulie Walnuts is probably the best known example. And he, I think, was pretty close to a very, very big jail term for being involved with one of the five families, I think. But it's not just The Sopranos in which that happens. Many of the mafia films, you know, from The Godfather onwards, have this kind of strange entanglement with the mafia itself. It is said of the script of The Godfather that the Italian-American League, which was a thinly disguised front for the mafia at the time, effectively ensured that the script could not contain the word mafia, that there was a there were a series of meetings that ensured that this couldn't take place.
Godfather's fine.
Yes, yeah. Well, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, you know, you get Cosa Nostra and all various other kind of euphemisms, but not actually the word mafia. And many of the street scenes in The Godfather effectively the film crew were only given permission after they'd paid a consideration to the local families and so on. But you see this right the way through lots of these films. So in a sense, Hollywood has always been kind of parasitic, I think, on actual crime in order to represent fictional crime. But in The Sopranos, that's played on beautifully with one of the characters, Christopher Moltisanto, who himself wants to write a mafia film. And so you've got a sort of Chinese box, really, of kind of entangled representations and representations of representations. And then very clear evidence, right the way from the 1970s onwards, that many of the US mafiosi were fascinated by these representations. People who described The Godfather as a kind of wonderful depiction of what we do. And then discussing it on wiretaps and so on, but also then carrying out particular kinds of killings or crimes which they'd seen in the movie. Again, that in itself isn't new. In the 1940s, I think it was, Richard Widmark's in a film called A Kiss of Death, and he is dressed in a black suit, black fedora hat, and black shirt and white tie, and he's chewing a matchstick. And apparently, a couple of months after that film came out, you could see all the young hoods on the streets of New York dressed exactly the same, chewing matchsticks.
So all that chewing matchstick stuff was done to this one guy in this one
Widmark,
movie.
That's right,
and
yeah.
I never knew that.
And there's loads of examples of that. So again, you know, do we say that, you know, which of those is the fiction and which is the fact? Because it's very difficult to disentangle the kind of, if you like, clear line between what we would regard to be historical accuracy and what we would think of as being no more than media representation.
Well, we'll come back to mafia in a minute, but I want to just finish exploring the idea of fictional bad guys or villains informing the real world. And you mentioned the Wild West, and I was curious at this idea about the Westward Ho painting actually being taken from a title of a prairie novel. And the idea of the prairie schooner, the actual wagon trains that they went out to explore the West in, yeah, also being based on the idea of a pirate schooner as well, where I never realised that those things took their cues from popular representation of piracy.
Well, kind of. I think, I mean, in a sense, many popular descriptions of the West from the sort of 1830s onwards are about the possibility of space, aren't they? So it's sort of unsurprising that people would imagine that space in fairly nautical terms, particularly because we're talking about a group of peoples who themselves usually migrated across the sea in order to escape from the cruelties of Europe and religious oppression at that time. So I think what's probably underlying all that is that sense that the outlaw, in all their diverse manifestations, usually occupies some kind of space which is outside what we would regard to be the normal places of civilization. So, you know, the pirate occupying the sea, Robin Hood occupying the forest, lots of examples of outlaws and bandits in mountains, in romantic literature, for example. And in this case, the idea of the kind of the spaces of the prairie, of the West, as being somehow beyond, outside of civilization, and therefore possible spaces of freedom, of autonomy, in a sense. It's not until the 20th century that we see a kind of a sense in which the city then becomes a kind of jungle, with particular sorts of spaces, alleyways, social clubs, spaces which are themselves free from surveillance of different kinds because of the complexity and density of the city. So we get the idea of the city as a jungle, for example, from English writers in the 18th century. And that metaphor is kind of fascinating in a sense, isn't it? Because the jungle is clearly a place where you can get lost in the same way that you could, you know, get lost in the wild prairies. You know, a man, this is the Jeffersonian vision of the US, right? A man can travel forever and you will always find space.
Space. And, of course, it always comes full circle in a way because you have these prairie schooners going out into the Wild West and creating these outlaw Robin Hood type figures. Again, you mentioned Billy the Kid as being, you know, a hero, despite the fact he was a villain. Jesse James, all terribly sad that his mother's arm was shot off by a nasty Pinkerton. Butch Cassidy, the Sundance Kid. These all nice people, then?
As I said before, I mean, most of these, the people I've written about in this book are probably people I'd cross the road to avoid. I'm a nice, well-brought-up academic. You know, what do I know about these kinds of things? Well, I suppose the best way of expressing it is to think about them as romantic heroes. I think the romantic period, European romantic period, is peculiarly important in this regard because I think it brings to the fore the idea of the individual who can stand outside the society and see things that other people can't see, that they have a kind of authentic relationship to life, to choices, to possibility, that the ordinary dullards like you and I, apologies, Peter, don't really have, because we're kind of stuck in the middle, doing what we're told to do, working for the man, getting up at 9 and, you know, going home again at 5 and watching somebody on telly, whilst these romantic heroes are doing something entirely different. They are making their own lives. They are brave enough to stand out against established authority. Now, the image of the romantic hero, particularly, say, as it's figured in Byron, for example, is someone who has almost a kind of spirit that allows them to be strong enough to resist the corruptions of the society they live in. So the notion of the individual who can, if you like, escape the blandishments of the city, escape the temptations of the time, and become themselves in a more intense and truer way. So many of the figures you've mentioned, Billy the Kid and Jesse James and so on, are understood pretty much like that, I think, as being figures on the frontier, but figures who are brave enough to resist very often the forces of industrialism from the East. And so the kind of the railroad and the banker and the big rancher and so on. So many of these characters are setting themselves against the established authorities of the time, and as a result are celebrated as heroes by the popular press and certainly by the kind of ordinary people of the time. Also, it's worth remembering that this is in the immediate post-Civil War period, the kind of classic age of outlawry, in a sense, and many of the outlaws you've mentioned are seen to be representing the South, too. Ah. So it's the kind of South against the North,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. But a largely agrarian and almost feudal South against an industrialised North. So there's a kind of, again, a sort of standing against modernity there. that the character from the East is very often represented in these Westerns as the kind of city slicker, someone who's a bit too good at talking. They've got kind of oiled hair and a rather sharp suit and so on. They're a bit too soon with everybody, as one novel puts it, the Virginian. Whilst the Western hero is someone who is very often quieter, slower, who doesn't need to jabber, who has a kind of presence, a kind, as I said, I use that word again, authenticity, that these Eastern characters don't.
That's interesting you go there, because that is a theme throughout your book. You have the pirates fighting against a nasty state East India Company. You've got the Westerners fighting against, the cowboys fighting against the nasty Pinkertons. And that's all well and good. And you've got Robin Hood having these as romantic heroes, possibly as well as being villains. But doesn't it get a bit more frightening when this Western idea of fighting against the state comes into the sort of philosophy like George Bush, the ultimate Texan rolling back the state, you know, Ayn Rand and, Atlas Shrugged, you know, the entrepreneur fighting back against the nasty Eastern people with all of their laws and social... And even Thatcher, there's no such thing as society. Suddenly, particularly with George Bush, you know, these Western heroes are being used to roll back statism, to roll back the nasty state. Is that really where we've ended up, or is that what
well, in this particular case, in each of the distinct kinds of outlaw that I talk about, there's different dynamics at work. Okay, so though we can make some generalisations about what all outlaws are like, at the same time we need to recognise the specificity of particular kinds of outlaws and contexts. So, turning back to the question then, if we want to talk about cowboys, about Western outlaws, then of course we need to understand that from the early 20th century, late 19th century, the idea of the cowboy is articulated as a necessary, a kind of inevitable feature of the American psyche. So it's not just Bush. I mean, it's a long way before that. Teddy Roosevelt was doing pretty much the same of thing. The notion of kind of a certain sort of rugged, very often masculine individualism, someone who doesn't need the nanny state, if you like, then becomes constitutive of a certain version of the American identity, I think. But nonetheless, one of the curious things about the presentation of the outlaw, say particularly in Hollywood films from the 1970s onwards, is what we see is outlaws as being presented as almost kind of countercultural figures. Rather than representatives of all that's right about the American way, they become figures who are standing out against the powerful, the corrupt, the industrial society, and so on. So in a sense, I think the dominant vision of the Western is certainly that it's broadly a kind of a pro-conservative genre, if you like. But I'm trying to suggest that there's another way of understanding this too, particularly if we focus on the figure of the outlaw themselves.
I can see that. And to come back to the state and control, you postulate there's a particular type of state that the outlaw prospered against, which was a state which was very prescriptive in what it did, i.e. prescribing alcohol, yet unable to enforce it. And you talk about the mafia in particular enjoying those gaps, exploiting those gaps, liking the idea that they're opposing an over-prescriptive state, and yet filling the gap when state isn't able to enforce that prescription. Is that fair?
Absolutely. I mean, the prohibition, you know, essentially what I was referring to in that section, was a fantastic business opportunity for organised crime, because effectively what it did is to badly regulate a market that was highly popular amongst the people. So not only did it provide enormous revenues for organised crime and for many drinks companies that then became legitimate after Prohibition was revoked, but also made the mafia into kind of, well, not necessarily just the mafia, but anybody who was supplying alcohol into a kind of a countercultural figure themselves, so into somebody who was both resisting an unjust law but also providing a service. That's in economic terms, of course, that's a characteristic of many of the, if you like, the economics of outlaws. So they are often supplying services. We spin back to smuggling, for example. So huge taxes in the 17th century on moving a variety of products, whatever they are, wool, brandy, stockings, whatever, around Europe. And effectively, the smuggler then supplies a service. They provide a way in which the ordinary person can get hold of something that they always felt they were entitled to in the first place. In exactly the same way now that, you know, if you pop down to your local pub in Coventry, Coventry or something, I'm sure you'll be able to find somebody to sell you some knockoff cigarettes that have been brought across from France.
A service industry.
It's a service industry, precisely. Yeah, but it's common that people regard tax as an unjust imposition, and therefore unsurprising that they're going to find a variety of ways of celebrating those people who bust the taxation.
And interestingly, you then go on to say that these organisations prosper in sort of high regulation, low enforcement regimes, but when regulation disappears, like when prohibition ends, you indicated a number of these champions of the people then became the rape and exploiters and large companies themselves that they moved into.
Of course, that's right. Well, yes, exactly. So once forms of regulation end, then of course what we see is that what was organised crime then becomes organised business. The distinction between the two, I think, is always a little difficult to draw a clear line on anyway. But the obvious areas in which 20th century outlaws, organised criminals, have prospered in have been those which are problematic for states in various ways. So the selling of sex and drugs, for example, and to a certain extent the policing of violence too. So all issues, if you like, that the state has difficulty in simply deregulating, but nonetheless that there are demands for, and hence, if you like, business opportunities too. The mafia are now, according to reasonably contemporary accounts, entangled with a whole range of other business groups that are moving lots of services around the globe. I'm using that euphemistically because, of course, it covers everything from prostitutes, drugs, arms, all sorts of stuff like that. But essentially, they're behaving as businesses. Businesses that are trading in services that wouldn't otherwise be provided. And bear in mind that these businesses exist because there is a demand for them. Mm-hmm. It's the paradox of the war on drugs, in a sense. The war on drugs isn't going to be won until there is no more demand for drugs. So it's not a question of cracking down on organised crime, it's a question of cracking down on people who want drugs.
And you extend that paradox even more, not just these nasty criminals becoming companies themselves, but you indicate as in the same way that the noble villains were seen as forces for good and popular figures, that companies, real companies or fictional companies, are always seen in movies as being bad, from the Bond movies where you have the multimillionaire tycoon to a particular film in science fiction where you mentioned the Terrell Company and Blade Runner, Omnicorp and RoboCop, and I can't remember the name of that Japanese-sounding company in the alien.
Weyland-Yutani.
Weyland-Yutani. But they're always evil because they're a company, Is that true that fiction up till now has portrayed companies as somehow...
I think it is pretty much an universal truth, that one. It's very difficult to find positive representations of business in most contemporary popular culture. This, in a sense, is a prehistory to this book too, because one of my earlier interests was precisely in this question of how business is represented in popular culture more broadly. And after I'd been through a whole range of science fiction films and popular film too, an iconic moment in lots of popular film is where the character tells the boss to shove it and then walks out of the door to the dog, the cat, to freedom, to the girlfriend, whatever the thing is. But the whole point, in a sense, is that often the source of the trouble that animates the plot is located in the organisation itself. The organisation doesn't usually solve it. It's the problem that needs to be solved. But one of the curious things when I started watching The Sopranos was, of course, that this was a portrayal of an organisation which was actually quite sympathetic.
Yes.
It's difficult.
You're rooting for them, aren't
you? Well, you kind of are, aren't you? And I was thinking about this in terms of, portrayals of the mafia from The Godfather onwards. So these are, terrible people doing terrible things, but, for most of the people who watch these films, our identification is with the bad guys, not with the alleged good ones, So I suppose that then spun out into a broader consideration of the positive representations of outlaws, as contrasted with the very negative representations of business organisations, I think, and very often negative representations of the state, too, as in a sense a coercive, conspiratorial form of organisation. So if we contrast these two images, then, what we've got in popular culture, I think this tells us something about the popular imagination. What we have is a view of the business organisation which is extremely negative, which presents businesses as usually utilitarian, selfish places populated by hungry careerists or megalomaniacs intent on world domination. With this view of the outlaw, the person who's working outside the established structures, outside the legitimate structures of the time, which is very positive, which presents them as romantic heroes of various different kinds, as the kind of people we'd like to be. When you watch a film about work and you see the boss is rarely the person you want to identify with.
This takes us almost to a conclusion, almost beyond the book in a way, but there are hints in it and where we've reached now. You've had this contrast, you say, the noble hero who's a rebel, who's a bandit against the bad company. Are the two now coming together? Is business being seen perhaps through that focus of the noble hero and being reinvented? For instance, you have The Apprentice with Donald Trump in the States, with Lord Sugar as a gruff rebel entrepreneur. You have Dragon's Den, where you have the dragons who are essentially sort of brusque individuals and all these people coming in with ideas. And you even have this Anne Rand thing where she has, people seem to be looking back, even Greenberg and Co. seem to be looking back to this hero, this rebel hero against the state. Is business beginning to learn and business, popular representation of business begin to learn from that and finding their own rebels to represent themselves in popular culture now?
Yes, I guess. I mean, in a sense, what we're talking about again is the entanglement of fiction and fact, isn't it? So if we look at many contemporary representations of business heroes, Richard Branson would be a fairly obvious one. They are presented in quite a piratical way, as if they are somehow heroic figures who could challenge convention and thereby gain some kind of market advantage. I suppose the question is, though, whether that means that the outlaw and the business entrepreneur are parallel figures. And I'm less certain about that. I can see a variety of ways in which business would like to claim that it was outlaw. That entrepreneurs are outlaws themselves. That's quite a flattering self-description. And it's one that then, in cultural terms, works against the idea of the dull, grey bureaucracy, 40 years sitting at the same desk, you know, all that kind of stuff, which I think is a common representation of work. The outlaw proper, I think, is opposed to more than just a particular business model. You know, if we take someone like Steve Jobs or someone like those were often presented in similar kinds of ways, what Steve Jobs basically did was to build a new kind of computer.
Yes.
Yeah, the outlaw is usually opposed to the authority structures in the society at the time. They're much more deeply rebellious and dangerous, I think. It would be difficult to imagine, going back to where we started, Captain Jack Sparrow from Pirates of the Caribbean running a major company. Yeah. The point of that particular kind of outlaw is there's someone who is too restless, too impatient, too suspicious of authority ever to settle easily for just making a new kind of computer. Yeah? So the appropriation of these rather outlaw figures by business, I think, is a pretty suspicious one.
Yeah. So that's where we reach that endpoint, in a sense. The outlaw is seductive, the company is always repulsive, and you don't think the company will ever achieve the shiny joy of being the outlaw themselves.
I'd rather not, in a sense. I mean, I think the attraction of the outlaw is precisely because it is an opposition to the dull grey world of work. And in a sense, the world of work will always be dull and grey. We can pretend otherwise, but much of it is going to be, you know, the tedium of turning up at meetings, looking out the window and wishing you were somewhere else. And in that somewhere else, in the woods and the trees and the forests and so on, the outlaw lies, and that's a figure of our imagination that exists precisely because we are inside.
Well, thank you for that. I think we'll have to leave it there, and we hope those of you listening didn't find it dull and grey, and hope it has enlivened your little piece of work wherever you are.